history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary Americans around you who have extraordinary stories to tell. Sometimes all it takes is a little bit of time to listen, and that's what we try to provide here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've heard from a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors over the years from coast to coast, and as we close in on the 75th anniversary of that date, which has indeed lived in infamy, we're going to hear from more of them in the weeks ahead. Very rarely on Hometown Heroes do we extend one veteran story over two episodes, but we're in that situation today. If you missed the first part of 95-year-old Delton Wally Walling's story, you can hear it and any other episode online at hometownheroesradio.com. Wally told us why he had one of his fingers removed to get into the Navy, what he witnessed the morning of December 7th from an observation tower overlooking Pearl Harbor, and why he goes back there every year, spending hours and hours visiting the people who come from all over the world to tour the USS Arizona Memorial. Those intense minutes he endured there so many years ago have in many ways shaped his life, and eventually Pearl Harbor will be his final resting place.
You've decided that when you're no longer here, you want your ashes to be spread on the USS Utah.
Yes.
Why did you decide that?
The Utah is a forgotten ship at Pearl Harbor. It's supposed to be kept up, everything, just like the Arizona. But because it's over on the other side, on Fort Allen, over next to the Aviation Museum, it's neglected. I donate and help take care. So I take money down with me, and I give it to the people that's maintaining, so I know where it's going. That is the reason that I want to be buried there, instead of off in the Arizona. It's a place where you can get to it. You can drive right over there to it now. So we take care of a lot of burials there.
So and it's so kind of your way of...
I want to be there with my people that left me many years ago. I can't be buried in the Utah because I was not on the Utah.
Right.
I can be... My ashes are buried in the water.
When you go back there and you take that little boat ride out to the Arizona, does that ever get old? You've done it so many times.
It never gets old. Never gets old. See, I'm on that boat going out there. When that boat stops, they hold everybody aboard. I go first and go in and go and say my prayers for the 1,171 that perished on that day. And then they let the people in behind me. You cannot stop. If I stop, they're sunk. The schedule is all throughout.
Right.
I got to keep moving.
There's so many people that want to talk to you.
And you can't stop.
Yeah.
No matter where I go in Honolulu today, we stop it.
Yet, you continue to go back because you realize that that role you play, even though I'm sure that's difficult sometimes, to have the stamina to deal with that many people, that there's an importance and a value to what you're doing there. When you look down at the water and you see those tears of oil come to the surface, what do you think about?
I can't really tell you how you feel. I really can't.
You know those guys are still down there.
I know those men are still there.
Yeah. You said that you do what you do to make sure the true story of Pearl Harbor is told. What is the lesson of Pearl Harbor? Why is it important 75 years later to still honor and remember that day?
Vigilance. Vigilance. Today, you're not paying attention. The people down the street, they don't want to get in there. They want to say something. Look what's happened. Everything that's happened in New York, it could have been stopped if they'd have said something to somebody. You cannot possibly stop this, what's happening, unless everybody gets in the act. And there's so many people that have a son or something that's a little off, and they don't want to tell about their son or whatever.
Sure.
You will never stop this. You'll never stop. You can fight ISIS in an army, but you cannot. They call this ISIS over here. It's terrorism.
So the lesson is Americans need to be alert.
You bet. You bet. One thing we didn't talk about here mm-hmm. is the Nevada.
Yeah.
The Nevada is the only ship that got underway.
Right.
The battleship.
Yeah.
And they got underway, and by going slowly, they can be hit with everything going. And when they backed away and backed into the pipeline across there and knocked that out and got into that, that's when we recognized that they were going to come out. When they started up that channel, man, we told Kimmel, you know, about it. He's going to stop that as quick as he can. Yeah, but it takes a little time to get to the ships that's being bombed and everything. And so they never got to it until it was right out in front of us. And by the time they got out there, you couldn't even see that ship from the fire and everything's on it.
Wow.
And we got to get it grounded. So we finally got through to them, and they run into ground at Hospital Point there.
Mm-hmm.
And that saved the channel from being blocked.
That's the important point, that if the Nevada had been stuck in the opening to the channel, then everybody's a sitting duck.
Set, yeah. And not only that, how long would it take before you could ever get a ship out of it
right.
or in?
Yeah, you're trapped.
See, that's a narrow channel right up there.
And you guys were involved in that communication?
Yeah, sure.
To let them know what to do or where to go.
But they was being hit so bad. I couldn't see. Well, of course, our captain and everyone's killed, you know, on the Nevada. I couldn't see how they could stay afloat very long.
Of all the things you saw then in December of 1941, is there one thing to you that was the most inspirational or motivating?
If you look down and see everything gone in front of you, how are you going to try to figure out which direction are we going? We don't know the full strength of the Japanese.
Of all the times that you've been back there on Oahu, and all these people, I mean, you've met admirals and generals and politicians and people from all over the world. Is there one thing that somebody said to you that really meant the most to you?
Boy, you really hit me, because I really can't say.
Too much. Too many.
Too much.
Yeah.
I'm in a different world when I get into Pearl Harbor. Just has to be, because that's where it all started.
What keeps you going back there every year? I mean, you've dealt with cancer. You're 95 years old. What keeps you going?
Because I want the story told as long as it can be. And it's going to stop very shortly.
And like so many of the guys I talk to, you don't like that word hero being thrown around.
No. 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 No way.
Why not?
Because my kids that was right with me there, they're heroes. They came back, but they're heroes to me. They're my heroes because they done everything right.
The sailors who are under your command.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had no problem.
Uh-huh.
They are my heroes, but not to heroes to everybody else because they come home.
What does that say about the guys who didn't come home? 406,000 Americans in World War II.
406, but 110,000 out of the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
They're my heroes. Because they gave me the freedom that I have enjoyed mm-hmm. for the past 75 years. I helped bury so many. They are my heroes. And they deserve everything that they can possibly get and their families.
You ever go to the punch bowl when you're out there?
Oh, yes. I used to run the tours through there because I made most all of the invasions of the Pacific.
Well, let's talk about that. So, and we've been talking about Pearl Harbor for so long here, but you spent a lot more time after Pearl Harbor in the Navy than you did leading up to it.
Oh, yeah.
So you went on an APA, an
APA
attack transport? APA
43. Uh-huh. Fayette, USS Fayette. We took it to the Pacific, and my first invasion was Kwajalein. You must remember that before the war started in World War II, we had never made a landing with craft. We didn't know how to do it.
Right.
So Tarawa was your first big mistake.
Yep.
We did not get the right information, the intelligence that we needed to attack.
Because of the coral reefs that you got hung up on?
The coral reefs and the barriers that protected.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a terrible, terrible mistake. But we got to learn. And so every time that you make it, you learn something else until you get it to perfection, like you did on the Normandy, you know. Look what would have happened if we'd have, right off the war, we'd have had to make a landing on Normandy. So we learned.
So your
time.
First one is Kwajalein. So there's Army guys in the south, there's Marines in the north at Roy Namur as part of that. Where were you?
We was on the south end.
And so your ship has a bunch of LCVPs, Higgins boats.
20-some.
That take the Marines or the Army into shore.
Because all these islands in Kwajalein is only 6 foot high out of the water.
Uh-huh.
They could be hit with everything, not like the mountainous islands.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't even really know where we was at. We were sitting there in the dark in the morning, and all at once we hear a siren go off. We know there's guns going to be going off pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, behind us is all the battle wagons sitting behind, shooting right over the top of us onto the island. And man, that island's lighting up. And we found out real quick, don't get on the other side of that island when they're low islands, because the big shells will come in and bounce off and liable to hit you out there on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know that until then. Luckily, we didn't have any hit. But boy, after it got daylight, the ship's cleared out from that other side if you're flying across there.
I believe it. And your job on the Fayette is communications.
Just communications.
So what does that mean? What kind of communications are you handling?
We're handling, during the war, up until the Marianas turkey shoot, everything was done by flag. Maneuvering of all the ships was done by flag. And when I had a squadron of ships to take care of, I put out the signals every afternoon at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for everything we're going to do at night. And all the turns and everything is done by the clock right on the second. Now, what's amazing to me, that we never cracked up a ship in the middle of the night.
Well, I was going to say.
Why didn't, with all the ships that we had out there, why didn't we sooner or later crack up somebody?
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. You better get those signals right, or else somebody could die.
In the afternoon, the admiral and his staff are deciding what's going to be done during the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they decide, then they bring up the written message of what they want done. Now, then I go ahead and put them into the flags and run them up. And this is how it's done. I'm the OTC. I'm the lead ship in this squadron of 30. I run up the signal. I don't two-block it. I don't take it all the way up. Leave it down 6 feet. And then every ship back behind me, clear back, five or six ships in each line, they run it up, but they leave it down until the last ship in that line understands that signal. Now, when he understands that signal, he two blocks it, the next one two blocks it, and it comes back to me, so I know that whole line of ships understand the message.
Got it.
Of what's going to be done. Now, I wait till everybody is all understand it, and then I pull it down, and that signal is executed for it to be handled later at night. Or it might be a signal that you're going to do immediately.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to change a fleet course and a fleet axis on guide to right to 060 simultaneous, that's going to be done in about 30 seconds because you got planes coming in and you run that in the air and everybody better get on to it immediately.
There's a lot that you can communicate in a flag.
What? You can tell any message there is. And that book is that thick.
And I wonder how many people really understand that, because it's so foreign to what we have now. I mean, you've got a smartphone, you've got an iPad, you can pull up all your pictures from Pearl Harbor the last 2 years, but 70 years ago, you're taking a flag and communicating pretty complex messages.
That's right. See, the whole fleet, up until the Marianas turkey shoot, when the Japanese decided that they'd take us on the last time, but what they didn't know was how fast we could build carriers, and they didn't know how many carriers we had there. So they come down with their five carriers to destroy us, but we had 14 there, and they walked right into it. 370-some planes of the Japanese and the Flyers was destroyed at the Marianas turkey shoot.
Right.
In fact, over all the decades since, they've actually upped those numbers. Estimates now are that potentially 600 Japanese airplanes were destroyed during the Marianas Turkey shoot, the aerial side of the Battle of the Philippine Sea in June of 1944. But before and after that, there were other things that Wally Walling experienced that I don't think he'll ever forget, including his perspective on the brutal battle for Iwo Jima. We'll touch on that and more when we come back. For photos, videos, and links to other stories about Wally, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, it is hard to forget the story of Jimmy Weldon. Or, as so many of us first heard him, the voice of that little duck on the Yogi Bear show, Yakky Doodle.
Help! Chopper! Chopper, they're after me!
Run, little feller!
I'm running!
Yakky, now that you're safe, tell me, where's your mama?
I know that, no mama. Would you be my mama?
Yep, even in his 90s, he can still do that voice. And you can see and hear for yourself at a special lunch with Jimmy Weldon on Thursday, October 20th in Clovis, California. Maybe you grew up with Uncle Jimmy Weldon and Webster Webfoot on TV in places like Bakersfield, Monterey, Salinas, or Fresno. You'll be amazed at his journey from World War II in Europe all the way to Hollywood and everywhere in between. And you'll be moved by just how much he loves our country. Thursday, October 20th from noon to 1:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District building, a lunch you'll never forget with the one and only Jimmy Weldon. For tickets, go to cbmcfresno.com or call 559-225-5095. That number again, 559-225-5095. I'll be there and I hope to see you there October 20th in Clovis.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 95-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Delton Wally Walling of Valley Springs, California, originally from Belding, Michigan. But for 5 years before, during, and after World War II, his home was wherever the Navy needed him. Eventually, a chief petty officer handling communications on the attack transport USS Fayette, he participated in landings at Kwajalein, Guam, Peleliu, Leyte, and Iwo Jima. More than a few enemy shells were headed for the ship during that time, but the Fayette always escaped unscathed.
We shot at all the time,
yeah?
And that was a phantom ship. It never got touched one time.
How is that possible?
Everything else in my squadron, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them got hit, but we didn't.
Were there some times where you were pretty sure you were going to be?
You bet. You couldn't possibly see why we couldn't.
What was your duty station on the ship? Where would you
right
be?
Right on the bridge.
Yeah, I figured.
High on the bridge, the highest point.
Uh-huh.
See, our life in a major battle, if that bridge is hit, we're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So our lives was worth 3 seconds. See, that's all. I'll tell you a little humor story.
All right.
We was at Guadalcanal, and now we're going to go to Cape Gloucester. Do you know anything about the Battle of Cape Gloucester?
I've read about it, but I wasn't there. You were.
So, in the middle of the night, 10 o'clock at night, we're pulling out of Guadalcanal to take supplies up to the Marines on Cape Gloucester.
Mm-hmm.
And As we got away that night, about 10 o'clock, darker than the devil. Can't see nothing, but you can hear the water going by the ship. And all at once we hear a spat, a loud spat on the water. We didn't know what that was.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, when we pulled in Cape Lutchester to put all the supplies ashore, a lot of the beer for the army and going ashore is missing. That was the empty cases that was hitting them. So now the captain right away just says the master arms to get everybody out on deck, look everywhere and find that bear.
Mm-hmm.
They did. They couldn't find the bear. You know darn well that that bear is on that ship. They couldn't find it. My quarters is up around the stack right behind the captain or an admiral if if an admiral is aboard.
Right.
So about 3 months later, in the middle of the night, we was going somewhere, and I decided to walk up and check on the boys on the bridge. Walk up there drinking beer. Holy smoly. I grabbed that bucket of beer and threw that thing over the side and said, now, where is that bear? Chief, it's in your quarters. Around the stack, around the stack is where I keep all the flags. They got holes in there about that big a square, and they slide the flag in.
Little cubby holes for the flags to fit into.
They pull it out and put the flag back behind it. And I didn't need flags for several months. Never looked in there.
So you were the one hiding all the beer.
I was the one hanging, but it was gone that night. Because we went down there. There wasn't much left.
Uh-huh.
Because they had been getting a five-gallon bucket of ice every night or every few nights and drinking beer.
Oh, that's funny. Are there some moments, and I want to hear about your other battles too. Are there some moments that you think back on and say, you know, that was really close? That could have been me in that situation?
Oh, yes. Well.
What are the ones that stand out?
Well, the one when we went in on Peleliu. You see, we didn't get all the information there. That was terrible.
That battle was a bit of a disaster.
That was a disaster.
A lot of Marines lost their lives.
Because we walked right into it, not knowing what's behind the mango groves, and couldn't see it. Fire shells in there, you're not going to blow up everything and get it out in view. So right. We didn't know. 32 days later, and all that loss of life. Then they knew that that decision by MacArthur to go in there on Peleliu was a mistake. They were thinking right. He was protecting his flank when we went in on Luzon.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want anything to come in behind.
Yeah.
So that's why he took that. But
so something happened there that made you think you might not make it?
Oh, yeah. In the battles and stuff coming out of those mangrove groves after dark, you know, you didn't know what was coming.
So you mean you were out on the bridge and stuff was coming towards the ship?
Yeah, they was firing out at the ships.
Uh-huh.
But another time, that was at Iwo Jima. And it's the first time that we saw the P-51 Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoon, here comes an awful roar of planes coming towards us about 50 or 60 feet off in the water. You can't see them.
But you can hear them.
You can hear them. And all at once we look out there, man, here they're coming. Well, hell, we're going for sure. And then they come by us and come up and make the rolls, and it's a P-51 Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
See, the airstrip is secured. That's the first time that I saw the P-51 Mustang. Boy, I thought that was the hottest thing. Well, it was up to the P-38 Lockheed Lightning. Boy, I thought that was the hottest thing. Well, it was up to the P-38 Lockheed Lightning.
And I'm just imagining, as you describe that moment, that you hear these planes coming. You think you're about to die, and then you see that they're American planes. So it goes from the worst to the best in a split second, huh?
In a split second, yeah. You see, I want to tell another story. Sergeant Bassalone, you know who he is.
One of the heroes of Iwo Jima.
He is a hero of Iwo Jima, but he was the first Medal of Honor at Guadalcanal. Because when the battle stopped in the morning at Guadalcanal. He had 32 dead in front of his pillbox. His gun is gone. His ammunition man is dead. He's the only one alive. Well, then we was able to hold 100. And then they took him back to the States and made a poster boy out of him.
Right.
He was the first Medal of Honor winner of the Marines in the Pacific War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was back there over a year or so, and he sold more bonds than any other man alive.
All the war bonds. He was the example that they used to sell.
But all the time, he wanted to go back to his men. So as we was coming, the squadron of ships is going to Iwo Jima. We picked him up at Guam, and he happened to come aboard my ship. So he was with us in the chief's quarters on this trip. So I got to know him real well on that little short trip. At Iwo Jima, we put him with his unit. He was on the third wave. The first two are dead. The men on the first two waves are dead or wounded. And when he came in with his, he saw that ahead of him and hollered to his men, "You're going to die if you don't run across that beach. Get across that beach. Don't stop. Do anything you can to get across." He hit him on the head. He called him bad names, everything, just to keep motivated to get him off there. Him and another sergeant. And he got killed 500 yards in there right next to the airstrip. I knew that young man. He was a wonderful young man. Sergeant Bassalone. So at Iwo Jima, then they gave him the Navy Cross.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've got a couple stations in San Diego there, 1170 AM The Answer and 1210 K-Praise. Folks listening right now, now they know when they drive up that freeway by Camp Pendleton and they see the John Bassalone Memorial Freeway, they know who that man was. And you said you got to know him a little bit. And I imagine just the fact that he's already a Medal of Honor winner, he's already done his part, doesn't have to go back, and willingly puts himself in that situation. Sounds like
those,
a hero.
Those kids that followed him off in that boat that day would have followed him anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you were ready to.
Well, I would have. See, I'm only laying off about 400 yards off the beach, and I'm taking back the casualties from that beach. That's why I had all of them aboard. I'm the first ship that took back the casualties that he went
to. So the Higgins boats, the LCVPs, would go from your ship to the shore to take troops in. They would also bring the casualties back.
If they could. Not every boat could take them back.
Right.
Because they're under fire.
But there was a day there at Iwo where you guys received over 400 casualties back on your ship?
I had, by 10 o'clock in the morning, on the morning of the invasion, I had 400 back aboard.
Wow. What kind of shape were these guys in?
They're either dead or just any kind. You see, Mount Sarabachi was 3/4 mile away. And the whole side of that mountain, it faces the beach. And so over time of 20 years of them fortifying, they knew every foot of that beach. They had to calibrate it from every one of those beach holes, those holes up in that mountain.
All the caves and tunnels in Sarabachi.
That's right. So all they had to do was wait so many troops and kill them. And that was what was happening the day of the raid.
And you're watching this.
I'm watching. See, on the bridge, you got the big glasses.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, of course, I watched the flags go up on Iwo Jima.
And you said it right. You said flags, not flag. So you saw the first flag go up, and you saw it replaced by a second larger flag. Did that mean something to you at the time while you're looking from your
God. Ship? Oh, my God. You know, of course, we don't know how far on shore that the Marines have got. But when we see, we're making progress. Because now we've chopped off the thing that's given us so much damage.
Mm-hmm.
And right ahead of us was the little boat basin. And our tanks in those days are small stuff. So we're watching the advance. It took them 7 days and only a few hundred yards that they could get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because, man, those tanks would start up and go a few yards and blow bottom side up. It was so fortified that those men, I don't know how in the world they ever advanced on Iwo Jima.
I get the sense, and I could be wrong, but just kind of reading between the lines here as I listen to you, it almost sounds like watching the Marines on Iwo Jima was more difficult for you than what you saw December 7th.
Right. You see, I tell everybody, December 7th was bad, and we lost up to 3,000 people, civilians and military personnel. But every island in the Pacific, we lost more than that. Why don't we think more of these islands where these kids died than just Pearl Harbor all the time? But Pearl Harbor had to get us in the war.
Yeah. And Pearl Harbor, you didn't know it was coming.
No.
But Iwo Jima, these are guys who have been on your ship that you're watching go to shore, and then you're watching them get killed moments later.
Yeah.
As you watch helplessly through those glasses, right?
Yeah.
Do I have it right?
Yeah.
And there's a story. You picked up a light, some Morse code signals of a boat coming back to your ship?
That was opening day at Iwo Jima. That was one of those small landing crafts about 25, 30 feet long that had the big steel con in the center of it.
Uh-huh.
Just all at once. Here's erratic lights flashing at me at our ship. And so I hollered to the captain below that this ship was trying to get hold. He says, see if you can find out what he wants. He finally got to me that he wanted to come aboard because his craft is sinking. I hollered to the captain. He says, get him aboard. So the guy came up there to me, and one man is hanging over the side dead. The other one, the one who was sending me the message, has got his other arm blew off. The armor that he uses for signaling. The left one is one he's sending the message to me, and he can't hardly send it.
So his right arm was blown off on Iwo Jima. The other guys on this boat are dead, and he's using his left arm
right.
to signal you while his boat is sinking.
And so he comes along. They throw the lines on the boat, and they rush down there and take off everybody, and the boat sinks right beside us right there.
Wow. Out of how many people?
Well, there were six that they took off that was dead. There's only six or eight on any of those small boats like that. They're just a gunnery boat.
And I know you're not looking for attention on that, and you're not bragging, but if you hadn't responded to his messaging and taken action, he would have died.
Yeah, he'd have died.
You saved his life.
Well, I might have, but I just happened to see him, and we're the nearest ship, and I'm sure that if he'd have come close to anybody, they would have took him. Because the closer you get, you see the condition.
You ever wonder what happened to him?
You never know about anybody that's on the ships. On the quarter in the ships, when we're taking them aboard, mm-hmm. we fill all the bunks, and then we line them up in the corridors, in their stretchers. The doctor makes a fast check on them to see how everybody is, see which ones they can save and which ones you can't. You might go by this hour and that man's alive. Go by the second hour and he's dead. And you got that every day. I'll tell you another. This just flashed into my mind. We was at Guam. We was taking back the casualties. And the sergeant come in, and he was hit right there.
On the bottom of the foot?
Of the foot. And the bullet was in there. So we was going to have to probe it and take it out.
Because you were so overwhelmed with casualties at some of these places, sometimes your quarters became... operating table.
The chief's quarters was
uh-huh.
the extra operating rooms.
Uh-huh.
See?
So you're around this a lot.
Oh, I'm there all the time. And so we put him on the table to take out that bullet. He says, Chief, he said, when they take out that bullet, I want it. Well, I didn't know what to tell why he wanted it. So they probed in there and they got it, pulled it out, and I washed it off. His arms are hanging down over because he's half out yet. See? We just knock him off with sodium pentothal, just enough to get out.
So he's still a little loopy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he starts to really come around. And I slipped that bullet into his fingers. And he rolled it around and he said, well, I don't ever say it here. I don't want to repeat just exactly. But he said some bad things. He said, get me ready to go back. I know who shot me. One of his own men shot him. See, he was laying flat on the ground. And he meant to shoot him in the back of the head and he hit him in the foot. Didn't dare put that man back.
So that's why he wanted to see the bullet, to see if it was one of ours?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a 45 slug.
Crazy things happen at war, huh?
Yeah. On the same occasion, within those same few days. See, it was a long time from Guam before we could get the casualties back to the hospitals in Tulagi and the Espiritu Santo down in New Hebrides. But all during this time, you're in the corridor there with all these people dying or whatever. Gangrene, you can smell that ship for a mile. And you're living there with it, right? Mm. Every day. It gets to you.
Understandably so. And often it never goes away. We'll discuss that aspect of it before we're done with 95-year-old Wally Walling. If you find your way to Pearl Harbor for the 75th anniversary on December 7th, you're going to find him there. And we'll hear the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with Delton Wally Walling. If you missed the first part of his story last time, you can pull up that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off before the break, he talked about the casualties his ship evacuated from Iwo Jima, his chief's quarters turned into a makeshift operating room, and that air of death and destruction that became a constant companion.
Really, after a while, never even thought about it. It's just another day.
Just got so used to the death around
you? That's it. See, I was evacuated by air from Guadalcanal, or from Tulagi. I had a serious stomach ailment come up, and so they put me in a hospital in Tulagi. That's when they're still fighting over there on Guadalcanal. Oh. So they put me over there in the hospital, and Tulagi had just been taken, and they had a small hospital there. I was in the hospital room in the afternoon, and there was 5 or 6 Marines that was in there with me. And their captain that afternoon came over with a 1/5 of 3 Feathers whiskey. And we decided to remove the whiskey. 20 minutes after we got loaded, emergency comes in. Grab your sea bags. We're evacuating you from Tulagi. It's a storm, rough storm, lightning everywhere. Put us in that old C-35. Away we go. Sick. Well, that little flight from Tulagi to Espiritu Santo, that plane didn't smell the same when they got there.
I believe it.
I come out of the hospital a few days later. I'm over there in the receiving station. So they put me in charge of the brig. I'm waiting for a ship to come in to get back up to Hollandia, New Guinea. While I'm there, a few days later, 2 LSAs come in from the States. And they couldn't navigate out of a 50-gallon drum. And they were 2 weeks over just getting in there to Espiritu. So they come over and ask me, they had to go up to Manus Island on the Bismarck Sea. And I just left that area. And they asked me if I would navigate them up there. I didn't know they was loaded with 100 tons of ammunition. I said, oh yeah, could that get me up there, you know, get me closer home. So I volunteered. Well, I can tell you that trip, you sat on thin ice all the way. Because all that area up there below New Britain Island is all held by and fighting Japanese. There's ships in there. There's boats in there. And then I get the message on there to be sure to check out every vessel you see. Because might be Japanese.
And you realize that you're on a floating bomb, because if anything, it all hits you guys, you're up in smoke.
So everything went fine until I came through the straits there at Cape Gloucester again. 10 o'clock at night, big, beautiful moon. And all at once I pick up a bogey, and he don't answer me back. Well, is he Japanese? Is he what? What is he? He's coming towards me. I'm going to the starboard just as fast as that'll go, only about 7 knots, so I'm not going to get away from him anyway. But I'm trying to evade him. And over the horizon it comes, and it's a four-stacker cruiser, and I don't recognize him. And so I jump up on the bow of that LSD, and they got the big 30-inch light. I can blast here for a mile, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just flashed it. Who are you? I'm American. You got to tell them, because they're broadsiding me. They're getting ready to let it go. The reason they're going to let it go is because on the top of that LSD, we got two tank landing craft on there that changes the silhouette of that LSD. See, and they don't have that change. All they're seeing is a strange ship, and there's lots of Japanese. So they're going to broadside me and let me have it. I told them who I was, and they come back and said, USS Canberra out of Sydney, and we're all shot up. Keep on moving off to starboard, because the San Francisco is under a tow behind us, and they may give it to you. Well, listen, I'm not going to get near San Francisco. Sitting right in the entrance is, I pull into Hallandia. Sitting right in the entrance is an ammunition ship. They keep the ammunition ships out of the harbors if they got ships on it. And as I'm coming, here comes my ship that I want to get on, and it's going over to Hollandia.
Uh-huh.
That's where it's headed for that night. So I talked to them, and they said, if you can get over there, we can pick you up tomorrow. So I went on in, went by the ammunition ship, went down, tied up about 2 miles down, tied up to shore, and that ammunition ship blew up. Prettiest sight you'll ever see is an ammunition ship blowing up. Just went by it 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, timing is everything.
And so then that night I got a small landing craft and went across to Hollandia and got back with my ship.
Getting back to your ship wasn't so easy.
It was, oh no.
You almost got blown up by one of your own ships that wanted to take you out, and then...
You see, I don't know. Just how lucky can you get?
Is that it? Do you think it's luck? Or do you think somebody had planned for you?
It just... Well, somebody looked out for me, I guess.
And still is, apparently.
Now, you want to know what I did to come out of the service? I'll just give you a short one.
All right.
February 27th. After I come out of the service... and 80% disabled, sent home with my pension of $110. They said, you can't work, be around people for about a year, and then you'll be all right.
And this is from what we know now is PTSD, and then
that's
it's
right.
You're shell-shocked, you're battle-fatigued,
In
and it's your
day,
fault, pretty much, is what they're telling you.
That's right. This is what they tell you. You joined to fight a war. You did it on your own. I didn't get drafted or nothing.
Right.
So... what are you crying about?
Mm-hmm.
What happened to you is tough.
You cut off your finger to get in the Navy.
It's tough.
Yeah.
See, I was home a year, but I got a wife and a little child. I've got to go to work. So I go to work, and immediately they start taking my pension away from me. Within a year, they got down to $10. And, of course, you read the story that I told them.
Yeah. You told them to keep their $10.
Yeah, and what they could do with it.
Put it where the sun doesn't shine. Yeah.
Then I left Michigan. When my wheels froze down to the cement back there, I said, I don't want it here. Mm-hmm. So I came to California, not knowing you don't come to California in the wintertime. There's no jobs.
Mm.
And there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I arrived in California with $6 in my pocket. I had to stand in those stores down there with the rest of the bums down there in Skid Row for a few days. When I arrived in Stockton, I made out an application any place that I could get it. A month later. February 27, 1947, Fiberbird calls me. Said, well, we don't have a real good job for you, but we need a sweeper. I said, I'll be there. So I went over there and started on the last day of February 47 as a sweeper. In 1952, I went to Baltimore. This paper company is the biggest on the West Coast. 27 plants. They got a lot of people. I went to Baltimore and took over their plant as a superintendent. September of 1952. You see how lucky in my life it's been. go back in the Navy, what happened when I first went in, how long it took me to become one of the youngest chiefs in the United States Navy. Short period of time. And then I come out in civilian life and devastated because I don't know nothing. In that short 5 years, I went to a superintendent, and I was with them 29 years, and I handled every job that they ever gave me. I also built 9 houses in Stockton. I was always doing something.
And you did that to avoid having to confront the echoes of war.
That's right. It keeps me on track. I have to stay busy. Even today. I'm working even today. When I was 55, I retired from fiberboard. I went back to sea, and I had 2 commercial salmon boats on the West Coast. So I'm known from Fort Bragg to Alaska. And I just retired that. I was 89 when I made my last trip to the South Pacific on a big tuna boat. I was down there 3 months. And when I come back into Newport, Oregon, and I was 89, bad night when I come in, and I looked in the mirror and I said, "You old son of a gun, what are you doing? You don't belong here." And so I quit.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is you talk about sailing even into your late 80s. Had to deal with a lot of weather over the years, but I'm sure nothing was quite like what's become known as Halsey's Typhoon. Oh. And you were in that.
Boy, you see, our carriers, our big carriers, you have to face into the typhoon, into the wave coming to you, because they're 100 feet high.
Right.
Now, when that wave comes in under that carrier and she's diving down into it, it just bent the front of the carriers up. Now they can't take the planes off. So after the thing was over, the only way they could take planes off was back up into the wind.
During that typhoon, what was it like on your ship, and what were some of the things that you saw?
Our ship was cracked right through the middle, right at the superstructure when it's over. We wouldn't have stayed up much longer.
Just from the force of these waves and wind?
Yeah.
That must have been a pretty rocky ride.
Oh.
If you're on that ship. What did it feel like?
You cannot stand up.
Uh-huh.
You cannot walk on the deck. Uh-huh. You've got to sit down. There's no way.
Are you thinking you're going to go under?
Oh, that's all you can think about.
Yeah.
You got your life jacket on, but what good is it? Although, we did pick up a lot of people after that typhoon. And you remember, one of those captains, they tried to court-martial him, because when Halsey called back, everybody, they was looking for the survivors for several days.
Yeah.
And they called back for everybody to come back. This one destroyer didn't, and he saved several lives afterwards, but they tried to court-martial him, but it didn't work.
And you saw some of those capsized destroyers?
Yeah. Well, I saw the hull.
How close were you?
200 yards.
So you see this whole destroyer.
Hull went over and then picked up the water in the stack. And then the next time it just went over and the screws kept turning.
So you're looking at an upside down ship with the screws, the propeller out of the water, turning in there. What are you doing when that is going on?
Nothing. The people on the bridge is just trying to hold that ship into the waves. Just barely headway, just enough. Because you don't want to plow into it, because your more force is coming up.
And what about when the war ended? Here you were there the day it began. You saw it all firsthand. To find out that Japan was surrendering, what did that mean to you?
Well, now, you see, I've been asked many times in the speeches, when the bomb was dropped, do you really think it was necessary? What did it accomplish? I let them decide. That bomb that we dropped in there altogether, say 300,000 to 400,000, it killed.
Both but on initial impact and radiation later. Yeah.
But had we made the landing, they estimated it would cost 2 million lives at Japan. They were way short. I made a trip with a woman that was on Japan at that time. She had went to visit and got locked there.
Uh-huh.
And every man, woman, and child was armed with a bamboo stick. So now, if we made a landing, we've got to kill everybody ahead of us.
And they would have fought to the death.
And they would have
fought to
the death.
They were fighting for the divine emperor. Yeah.
So we're talking about 20 million.
Well, and those estimates said at least 1 million Americans would die.
That's right.
In the invasion.
That's right. So I leave it up to them.
The math tells the story, huh?
The math, yeah. I'm so thankful to all the people in my life that I've been acquainted with. They've been a part of my life. I'm very thankful to have known them all.
I'm looking at some pictures here on your wall, and just a couple of things come to mind. One picture is Washington, D.C., and you're both at the Marine Corps Memorial with that giant rendering of the flag that you saw when it happened.
Yep.
The first time and that second time that's depicted there. And then the World War II Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about while you were there at the World War II Memorial?
Well, I really don't know what I thought. It's a wonderful thing to see. One thing I was very happy to see is the memorial to the women flyers of America during the war. Because they got nothing. They was just dumped right out with no pension. Mm-hmm. No recognition of any kind. That was so wrong.
Since then, that has been remedied a little bit. Congressional gold medal for all the WASPs. And you mentioned the Women's Memorial at Arlington. And just recently, the first WASP was buried at Arlington after quite a legal fight. The other picture I see over there is you skydiving.
Yeah.
When did you start doing that?
Well, I've skydived off and on many years. But I just for kicks. When Bush made his jump. And
former President George H.W. Bush.
When he made his jump. And it was put on television and all this stuff. And I thought, holy mackerel, I'm a little older than he is. Why don't I do it? So I went down and I did it.
And since then, you do it every year on your birthday?
Yeah.
If you're
every
up to it?
Every year on my birthday.
So May 6th of 2017, are we going to see a 96-year-old jumping out of a plane?
You will if I can walk over there to it.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story and keeping the memory of your fellow veterans alive. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you think is really important for people to know?
Well, I don't think so. They've got a pretty good cross picture of my life and how I think.
What are you proud of? What are you most proud of?
I'm the most proud of helping anybody that's in trouble.
Well, I'm just thinking about all this, Wally. You're there on December 7th. You saw what you saw. So many things throughout the war that you witnessed, things that you had to survive. In your life since, as you said, you've been going. You skydived on your birthday. You've caught some of the biggest fish in the world. All these things that you've talked about. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you still want to do?
Maybe there is, but I've run out of time. This cancer of the bone, you're limited to the time that's left.
And you don't know how much that is.
And they won't even talk to you about it. You're going to go. No, you can't stop it.
It's not being treated.
No, you can't treat it. All you can do is take the pain medicine. And I don't take that because the minute you start taking this high-powered stuff, you're going to lose more of what little brains I got left.
And you need your brains because you still have a story to tell.
That's right.
And people to tell it to.
I won't turn anybody down.
I get that. And I don't usually ask this question because it's not an easy one to answer. But with what you just shared, that you have a cancer that you know eventually is going to run its course, that you know this is not unlimited, but that you're going to keep going as strong as you can, as long as you can. And I'm thinking about how much time you spend trying to make sure the rest of us remember Pearl Harbor and remember the lives lost that day. What about you? How do you want to be remembered?
Just what I'm saying. I want to be remembered. The man that didn't let the rest of the world forget the story of Pearl Harbor or the Pacific. I went to the last, and I'll do it to the last.
I believe you. Thanks, Wally.
And I'm so grateful to have met so many wonderful people that's taken a part of my life and made me what I am. I thank them all. I'll go out fighting. I started out in life fighting. I'll go out the same way.
Truly one of a kind, Wally Walling. You might enjoy the photos and videos of Wally at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear from another Pearl Harbor survivor next time. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.